talks that we did at the beginning were meant to remind people that A, there was a world out there. B, there were other literatures out there other than the literature produced by American writing programs at this moment. And C, that much of that literature had to do with historical catastrophes, which if they seemed remote now, had indeed happened and were worth being reminded of.
Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Vital Interest Podcast. So this week, I thought it might be a good idea to take a little time out. And instead of thinking about politics and all of the current goings on in the political sphere, to just think about something else. And I thought it might be a good time to take a deep dive into the world of reading and what reading can do for us when we're not always having to be poised to act. And it doesn't have to be a long pause, but just a little bit of reflection. And so I thought for today that I would bring in somebody who has spent his career thinking about giving books to other people. His name is Edwin Frank, and he is the editor of the New York Review of Books Classics Book Club. And for 20 years, he has been curating books, lost books, he calls them, translating them when they need to be translated. He's the editor of two collections, The Red Thread, a selection cultivated from a variety of pieces that had appeared in the classic series over the 20 years. And earlier in 2002, he also produced a collection of unknown masterpieces that were pieces taken from the introduction to the books that had been written over his time curating these books. In 2015, he published a compendium of poetry that he had written entitled Snake Train. And I just wanted to talk to him because some of the books that he's found in the last year, even though he picked them a while ago, have been about survival, about isolation, and about how we get through very difficult times. So joining me today is Edwin Frank, the curator, editor, and master thinker behind the New York Review of Books Classics Book Club. Welcome, Edwin. Welcome to Vital Interest Podcast. It's a delight to have you here.
My pleasure.
So for 20 years now, more than 20 years, you've been curating a series of books that you've referred to as a gathering of ghosts that you have found abroad mostly, but not only. And I just wanted you to tell our listeners what's on your mind. What was on your mind when you started this series? And we're going to get to what's on your mind now.
Well, the series started in 1999, though we started putting it together and thinking about it a few years before that. And at that point, what I had discovered through a job I'd had earlier that sort of morphed into this job was that a lot of books that I cared about a lot had fallen out of print. And I didn't really understand. I hadn't myself been involved in publishing up to that point. So I didn't understand the most elementary thing that books tend to go out of print because they just don't sell. Well, it seemed all sorts of books, both amusing, inquiring, delightful, upsetting, books that did the whole range of different things that good books should do, were unavailable to readers. And this seemed something that would be worth fixing.
These were books originally that you knew about how?
Well, I'd always been a big reader from early on, and not only a big reader, somehow just, you know, sort of like the blind man with the elephant, the whole world of different things books could do. I guess I had been sort of groping over trying to figure out what it was like from an early age. And I had some idea. I mean, I knew where the trunk was or something like that. And then I had also lived abroad a bit. So I had some experience of French literature and was quite interested in literature and translation, not because it was in translation, but because there were interesting books written in other languages. or I had a kind of grounding in these things that I had come by half formally through education, half informally, just out of curiosity. This was, in some sense, the point of the red thread, this sort of thread that one follows. It seemed to be various clues along the path were missing, and it seemed a pity that those clues would be missing, and it seemed like it would be a nice idea to start scattering them like Hansel and Gretel breadcrumbs along the way of readers. That was, in effect, the initial idea.
So basically, you're a curator for the rest of us, and you commission the translations of them?
Well, we began simply publishing books that had fallen out of print. So that was a mixture of existing translations and also books in English that had also fallen out of print. Within a few years, we began to publish books in new translations or in so yes, I commission the translations and then edit the translations. Yeah.
And sometimes you do American books.
Yeah. I mean, our single most successful book, I mean, is John Williams's Stoner, which is very much it's an all-American book. But
but there's also Diane Johnson's book.
We do a lot of American writers. With foreign writers, a great deal of literature, for lack of a better word, canonical. A lot of canonical writers in foreign literatures are not available in English. They are anything but well-established in English. So with foreign literatures, often we are simply translating for the first time a book that is very familiar indeed to readers of that language. With American books, more often we have the book that a writer like Williams, who wrote three novels over as many decades, and each one was really quite different from the other, though now you can see there's certain similarities. But that's not the world's greatest way to conduct a literary career. People forget about you between your books. And if your books are each different, they don't see what you are really after. In the case of American books, they're more often rediscoveries, books that have really fallen under the radar of most readers, which is for a different reason from the reason that the foreign ones have evaded attention.
So let's talk a little bit about how you choose these 500 books. Do you have the same number each year, or do you?
Roughly in the classic series, we do somewhere between 25 and 28, something like that.
A lot of books. So how far ahead do you choose them? How do you go about it? What's the process?
Rigorously by whim is how I try to choose. But that in the sense that I like to be open to something that will surprise me and something that I hadn't expected. At the same time, there's certain strands, there's certain things I really follow up on. There's several writers I publish extensively. There are languages that we publish a variety of different works in, and we're on the lookout for other...
Like Russian?
Russian, Italian, Hungarian to some extent. Yeah. Russian, Italian, and French. German now are probably the languages in which we have the deepest...
I thought it was that you picked them by you can't say the names of the writers. I can't tell you how often I get one of these books. And I'm like, what? you just learn to know them by the titles, which is not fair to the authors. But I want to get a little bit into the grittiness of the relationship between what you choose and what's going on in the world. So there have been, you know, pivotal moments in history where your readers very much are looking for answers in books. And so one of the questions I had, given that the center started as a center focused on terrorism after 9/11, did 9/11 have an impact on your choices? And if so, how did that turn out?
It did, and perhaps even more the determined march to war in the years subsequent to 9/11.
The war in Iraq.
A war that I thought was ill-advised. But certainly we did a number of titles in that time which were about war and which raised questions about war. We did Simone Weil and Rachel Besloff's War in the Iliad, Weil's essay about the Iliad is a pacifist essay from 39. Besloff's is an essay from 44, in some ways a response to Weil's reading of the Iliad as a kind of machine of destruction, the whole poem as a kind of depiction of destruction action, where Besloff, I think, not directly responding to the resistance, does try to articulate a sense of the ways in which war may be necessary and may not be entirely degrading of humanity. We also did Alistair Horne's Savage War of Peace, which is about his history, the only history, I think, still in English of the Algerian Revolution, where he talks at some length about the French government's involvement in torture. And that book ended up being actually cited in a Maureen Dowd column as a book that George W. Bush was reading. We worried that he had only read the beginning and not the end, and was thinking that what a great idea the French had to go in there. But that, anyway. And then finally, C.V. Wedgwood's The 30 Years' War, which is about the 30 Years' War, which is in some sense a narrative history about the beginning of the system of nation states and the ideas of sovereignty that we still work under, for better or for worse, to these days. So those books were all published in order to provide some context in those years. And interestingly, they were books that continue to be fairly widely read.
And are there other moments that have led to choices, you know, historical, geopolitical moments in time that have led to, okay, let's address this through the books we pick?
Well, in some sense, the very beginning of the series, which, as I said, was 99, the end of the Clinton era. I mean, the Clinton impeachment was nothing if not an exercise in navel gazing. So America, having in some sense complimented itself on being the hyperpower or the super hegemon or what you will of the moment, in a curious way, it took the rest of the world for granted, had come to take the rest of the world for granted. Fukuyama gets a lot of, is always being dragged over the coals for saying it was that was the end of history, and we know it wasn't. On the other hand, in some sense, he was certainly right about the atmosphere, which was one in which a certain kind of complacency had settled in. And in that sense, the books that we did at the beginning were meant to remind people that A, there was a world out there, B, there were other literatures out there other than the literature produced by American writing programs at this moment, and C, that much of that literature had to do with historical catastrophes, which, if they seemed remote now, had indeed happened and were worth being reminded of.
Well, so what about the countries that need more attention now, that are always in the news? Countries like, I know you've done books from China. Mm-hmm. Is that like a high priority now? What about other countries? Are you looking to these other countries, or is it just too much to take on?
It's not too much to take on. You can only take it on over a certain amount of time. We certainly have been focused on doing Chinese books. Yeah. To me, a very important writer in the series is the Chinese writer Eileen Chang, who's also a very popular writer in China, who died in the 90s after being a recluse for many years, whose books are in part political. Arabic literature in Arabic is one which is something that I would like to do more of. The whole interesting, slightly unconscious process by which a target language develops a relationship with a source language and develops not only gifted translators and experienced translators, but a kind of literary relationship with that other language is still in formation with something like Arabic. Arabic both is drawing on the Western tradition of fiction in the 20th century, but also has its own very, very deep literary traditions, which don't have obvious parallels in the Western traditions. And so the accommodation between those two is a work in progress.
I want to talk about COVID a little bit. First, let's just start with the metrics of it. What has COVID meant for the reading public? Not for bookstores so much, but the reading public. Do you have any sense of that people are reading more, that people are hungrier for something to fill up their time with, or not?
I think they are. And it's been, in a way, fascinating, and insofar as there's room for in a catastrophe for gratification, there's, I suppose, something gratifying about the fact that I think people kind of circled their intellectual and emotional wagons at the beginning of this, and also I think felt strongly that they wanted to support things that gave meaning to their lives, and also that perhaps that they hoped gave meaning to other people's lives, partly too, because they were going to have a lot of time on their hands.
But with you, it's not writers that matter to them. It's writers that they should discover because they'll just be so delicious. It's not necessarily writers they've heard of. As you know, every single one of these books, when you finish it, you're like, how come I never heard of that writer? So all I'm asking is really, is there like this new kind of hunger for reading generally?
A hunger to know that there is a world out there. I mean, I think if you take a book like Grossman's Stalingrad, you know, this is an account of a devastating situation which puts ours in, you know, it's not ours a lot. Could be worse, you know, that. But it's also, in some sense, it is a book which we did, you know, last year, I think. It's a great novel, but it's also a socialist realist novel. It's an uplifting novel about how people can survive and endure a trauma of a devastating sort. And I think that too is a food for a kind of nourishment.
Have you ever been surprised by the way in which the books you pick, which come out after you pick them, right? That process of picking them, of translating them, of producing them, and all of that, they come out and then they speak in sort of a uniquely pertinent way to the times. And I'm thinking now of the quarantine experience that we've had in this country since February or March, that a number of the books that you picked for 2020 were books that spoke to isolation, Malakoff, that spoke to survival, Tarker the Otter. Did it surprise you when all of a sudden these books just were about the newly normal human condition?
Well, I mean, books have their fates, and of course, it was entirely a surprise that Malakoff, which in a way...
By Henri Bascule.
And a book about a young man who has received an inheritance and the conditions of his receiving the inheritance as he spend 3 months in the winter in utter seclusion in the deepest French countryside. Of course, I had no idea that that book coming out in April would have any something. You know, I mean, that book I had acquired 3 years ago, the translation had been done 2 years ago, I'd been able to schedule it a year before. The notion that we would all be undergoing an experience comparable to what the hero of that book undergoes was completely unforeseeable. And so, the oldest book can surprise us by its immediate pertinence. And if it's a good book, you know, it's news.
So maybe you should pick some happy books. But it's such a dislocating time right now. Does that figure into anything, or are your choices basically made in the same way? Or do you have meetings with whoever you discuss this with to say, gee, we're living through such unsettling times. Maybe we should pick books about unsettling times. Do you have this conversation or no?
Well, it has to be said that the series has a lot of books about unsettling times. That's not something that...
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yes.
We had picked up, this is another grim book, but sort of timely, or distinctly timely, a book by the African-American writer William Gardner Smith, which will come out next fall, called The Stone Face, which is about a young Black man who's gone to Paris in the early 60s. He has... left America because he can't really bear the racism in America. He finds Paris much more welcoming, but then, this is a book set in the early 60s, begins to be aware of the racist treatment of the Algerian population there and feels a complicated solidarity with his Algerian friends. The book ends, in any case, with what was for a long time the only account of the notorious incident in which the French police in cracking down on a demonstration against France's Algerian, the war in Algeria, shot a still unknown number of people and disposed to dump the bodies in the Seine. Something the French government continued to deny until relatively recently. So in that sense, it was a book that was the only real account of this atrocity.
Yeah, I mean, the series has a bunch of memoirs, right? Mm-hmm. And so that would be kind of in that realm, even though it's not quite a memoir. I wanted to ask you about the internet. Mm-hmm. The internet seems to me to have changed what we do with our reading time. Do you feel, in a way, that it's changed reading as an activity?
I mean, there's a way in which I think the internet has encouraged, in a a minority, but a committed minority, a greater attention to reading as a way of getting away from the internet, and also a greater attention to some extent, a greater historical awareness of the ongoing life of the book and what books have done in the past. I mean, that could also be by contrast. I think the internet naturally makes us all interested in information technology, since we are living through the midst of a major transformation in information technology. So one looks back, you know, when one talked about the print revolution in the past, one was in some sense taking it for granted. Now it becomes a very distinct moment in its own. So in that way, the internet also, by way of trying to figure out what's going on now, we look back a bit. That's another part of what I'm talking about. The way one reads on the internet is, I think, quite different from the way one reads a book. And I know in my own case now, after months of being separated from having I much prefer to read the newspaper in print form, but to read the newspaper day after day on a device is, in some sense, to be continually skipping in and among things. I notice, I mean, one always skims a newspaper to some degree, but one skims it much more relentlessly, it seems to me, on the internet. There's also the odd feature that, I mean, this has been much remarked by other people, that looking at two pages of a newspaper, you sort of see the dimension of the whole story. Looking at a list or a listicle of different things you can read about, you tend to jump to the, well, clickbait or the thing that you are already used to following all the time. And this is also true of shopping on the internet as opposed to a bookstore, that apart from the algorithmic recommendations of things that you may wish otherwise, the sheer serendipity of encountering something you had never known existed at all on a library shelf, be it a private one or a public one, is something that doesn't happen or doesn't.
Right. The serendipity of reading a newspaper, if you're just, you know, reading it in physical form, the things that come across your screen are your brain, are things that
that's
you would.
Great, isn't it? I thought it was that.
Yeah. Okay. There we have it. Now we know what's happened to us all. Yeah. One of the things that kind of runs through comments that you've made in the past is education. Mm-hmm. So essentially what you're doing is assuming the role of, that we don't have a category for, but I'm going to give it a name as if it had a category, of public educator, mm-hmm. right? Here are things that you might like to educate yourself with that you will get immense pleasure from, by the way, right? That's mm-hmm. sort of the approach. And I just wondered about how you see the role of the education system and what people are taught to read and how they're taught to read and how they're taught to read after they leave the education systems of the country and the general idea of public education outside of the schools. And so I guess my question is, do you think the schools do a good enough job making people want to read?
I think there is an unfortunate tendency, especially in America, to think about literacy before reading books, to think about reading as a kind of tool rather than as an experience. Reading is, of course, a tool, and it's a necessary tool, and it needs to be, and children need to be taught. And in a certain sense, reading is a bit like playing the piano. It requires certain skills and certain ways of noticing things and a kind of internal voicing as you go along too of what's in front of you. The tendency to treat reading as a way of absorbing information as opposed to an activity and a kind of contemplative or reflective activity in its own right, as well as an enjoyable activity, is, I think, overly pronounced. You know, my son went to a Steiner high school. A Steiner's classroom will have around its edges postcards of Kafka, of Saul Bellow, partly because those people were thought to have connections with Rudolf Steiner, but of great writers in the old-fashioned way that libraries had names of great historians and what you will. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because there is an assumption that it's a good thing to have good books in your head and good poems in your head and to have them as things you can go back to and think about again and mull over and change your mind about. Mm-hmm. And possibly hate for a while. And this is by contrast to certain kinds of often very expensive education in this country, where you're given a book and you're taught to perform symbolic analysis on it so that you'll know next time you run into a book, you'll know what to do to that one. So rather than to absorb it and let it in some sense rain on you. In order to foster a certain kind of growth. I think education, which is a lot about how, frankly, about how to spend, how do you use your time, partly, of course, usefully and productively, but also partly because, partly simply because one living a life is to have an experience of time, which one wants to have that time be meaningful rather than not.
I one other question that I just wanted to ask you, because it's kind of out there in the literary world, and it's not exactly pertinent, but I wanted to ask it, which is the novel. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people who pontificate these days about how, you know, the novel's over. It's over because of changes in romantic patterns. It's over because of changes in what's literarily considered good or even acceptable. It's changed because so much else is going on in the world, the internet, other forms of art that can be expressive. How do you think about the novel today?
I think the novel is in a way more established than it has ever been at this point. How do people mostly absorb whatever information they get about history is largely gotten from many, many people through historical novels, which are often works of research in advance, as well as drama. Well, this was beginning to happen a century ago, and I think this change really happened after the First World War. But if you go back to 1900, that novel was certainly a well-established genre, but there were many other, there were writers who wrote for and entertained people in a whole range of nonfiction genres that were equally well-established. Now, interestingly, we now have this category, narrative nonfiction, which is to say nonfiction that is basically presented to you using some of the formal devices of the novel. Mm-hmm. So if there's anything that is particularly difficult, I think, for novelists at this point, it is that the novel is so entrenched in the ways in which we think about our lives and in those tedious graduation ceremonies where people say everybody's life is a story. It's almost taken for granted. I mean, I wasn't terribly taken by Karl Ove Knausgård's My Struggle, but I thought that part of the struggle going on there, and I didn't just think it, he says it in the book and says it again, is a way to try and make the business of being a novelist novel simply by recording in endless detail all his experiences, his thoughts, and in some way trying to break out of the form of the well-trained novel like a parade dog.
Yeah. Well, it is the age of narcissism. So I always end with the same question. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what makes you hopeful?
What makes me hopeful? good question. Relatively little at this point, though I am hopeful for political change. And I do hope that if we have political change, I think it's not unhopeful that America could, with certain basic changes, begin to be responsive and responsible to its citizenry in a way that it hasn't been for the last 30 or 40 years, and give it the basic services that any well-established state should have. And that with that, perhaps there will be a resurgence of a sense of the common good, which we are sorely missing right now.
Yeah. Well, Edwin Frank, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us, and more importantly, for sharing all your books with us. Okay. So I am definitely looking forward to the next 20 years of happy books.
Okay, right. I look forward to that too.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast. In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interest online forum at centeronnationalsecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.